Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm going to be speaking today with Rob Johnson. He's president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and host of the podcast Economics and Beyond. We're going to be talking about the State of the Union, a bit about Biden's speech, and more about how the two of us see things. And you can learn more about Rob's work at ineteconomics.org. That's all one word, I-N-E-T. economics.org. On Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. And we look at politics, economics, environment, science, health, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The show streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn.com, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally, TerrenceMcNally.net. Rob Johnson and I have struck up a habit of doing a post-election show. The last time Rob and I spoke for this show was November 11th, 2022, a few days after the midterms, and the time prior to that was a couple of days after the 2020 election. And we plan to do another one this fall. But when I first proposed this conversation to Rob by email, I invited him to join me to have a State of the Union conversation, looking back and looking ahead. How are we doing? To talk about things like the economy and the media and public's perception of it. Politics, what are the stakes? How nihilistic can the Republicans get? Is Biden the best the Dems can offer? And if it's all about turnout, what needs to happen? And the culture wars, do we think they actually matter? And how can they best be handled? We always talk about domestic issues and about global ones like climate change and the pandemic. But I don't think we've talked much in our previous conversations about foreign affairs or foreign policy. But this time, Ukraine and Gaza will probably dictate that we have to take those on. And big picture, what are our most important challenges? What should be our priorities? What's working? Why might it be working? What do we need more of? Those sorts of things as, you know, sort of how the two of us see the state of things. And when I pitched it, I was assuming it would happen sometime in February, but it turned out Rob was going to be away for most of that month. And when he returned, he pitched today, which is the day immediately following the State of the Union. It's Friday, March 8th. So it's inevitable that we will respond a bit to the speech while we lay out our own visions. I look back at how I introduced our 2020 conversation. So that's the one that just followed Biden's election. And some of what I said at the time, looking ahead to Biden's first term, this is from that intro 4 years ago. We face some big challenges, global health of humans and the rest of nature, climate change, nuclear war, gross inequality. For the 4 years of Trump, we've ignored or aggravated most of them. We're going to go through more tough times, even just in terms of the pandemic and the economy. But add natural disasters, fires, police brutality, urban unrest, and perhaps the survival of democracy itself. We need to come together to deal with both our existential crises and our tough times. Obama was elected to lead the nation and the economy out of the crash. Biden is tasked with leading the economy and the country out of the pandemic. But we said then, Rob and I agreed, that Biden fails if the best he can do is deliver Obama 2.0. And I found this quote. This, again, is from that 2020 intro. I found this quote on the website of the Institute for New Economic Thinking. When the economic system breaks, it spares no one, but such a crisis can provide an opportunity to work together to create real lasting change. This is one of those times, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to transform economics as we know it. Now, that had been written following the Great Recession of 2008, 2009. But I think the pandemic and its jolts to the economy offered perhaps the same once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And then I said, under Obama, we didn't transform economics. Not only that, we didn't respond in any meaningful way to most who were hurting. Many of these people had left felt behind long before the crash, and enough of them turned out at the polls in the Rust Belt in 2016 to elect Donald Trump. So those are the words from 2020. I read them again now just to help set the context as we look back at the first 3 years of the Biden administration. And so let me tell you about Rob Johnson. He's been a player among the elites but he's also a plain-speaking, passionate critic of an economic, financial, and political system that leaves too many behind. He previously served as chief economist at the U.S. Senate Banking Committee, was an executive producer of the Oscar-winning documentary Taxi to the Dark Side. He was management director at Soros Fund Management, and as I said, is now the executive director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and host of the podcast Economics and Beyond. Welcome again, Rob Johnson, to Freeform, A World That Just Might Work.
It's a pleasure to be back.
Great. And as I said, we're recording this Friday, March 8th. So let me ask, any response to that introduction, that look back at us looking ahead, if you will?
Well, I think there's a feeling that I get that people are in distress now, whether it's foreign policy related to China and Taiwan or Ukraine or Hamas and Gaza and so forth. But I sense that things have been coming unraveled for quite a long time, and that actually Donald Trump in 2016 was a symptom of that distress. He was the kind of guy who could get up at the Detroit Economics Club right after he got the nomination in Cleveland and say, what's wrong with the big three automakers? They're taking all the jobs away from you in the state of Michigan. And the people in the state of Michigan who had supported Bernie Sanders against Hillary Clinton in the primaries voted just barely for Trump in what was a Democratic state, in large part because a lot of people stayed home saying that the Clinton coalition did NAFTA, privatization of prisons, education reform, that all put more pressure, supported elites and put more pressure on the people of the state of Michigan. And Trump was the first person to stand up. And what bothered me was many of my friends who are having master's degrees, MBAs, MDs, PhDs, were all voting for Trump based in Michigan. And I was a little taken aback by that. I said at the time, he seduced you and he'll abandon you. And I think 2020, all of the people that I knew of this group of eight close friends, it was 6-2 in favor of Trump in 2016. It was 8-0 for Biden. But I don't think we're out of the woods now. I think we are in that distress.
I wish I thought that foretold the future. Go ahead.
And so what I'm seeing now is a lot of decline in the faith and confidence in both governance and expertise. Polls by people like Richard Edelman or Gallup show that things have really crumbled. Everybody's viewed as a marketing man for concentrated wealth and power, not as a visionary for a citizen. I always say Bob Dylan's song, One Too Many Mornings. Well, the INET song now is there's three too many markets. There's a market for expertise, not for the common good, but whether it's university endowments or individual consulting contracts, people want to please the powerful. Secondly, politicians need lots of money in order to run for re-election and survive. And that is another source of concern. And third, what I'll call the media needs advertising, and the advertisers aren't going to get scrutinized because it will chase away a source of revenue. So the idea that we have a capitalist democracy where the capitalism is embedded in and governed by the democracy and therefore morally okay, I think is a false assumption, because there are three too many markets for that parable to take place. And I think that distress needs people to rise above. And turning the corner here to the State of the Union message last night, I think a lot of people went in saying Biden shouldn't be a candidate because he's too old and too tired and he doesn't have the energy and he's too old to care about the future. I thought he did a very good job last night of projecting visions of the future, being funny, sharp, crystallized. So a lot of people walked out there and said, well, the advantage of someone who's old and experienced is wisdom. And the disadvantage is if their energy level is low. On that night, he showed his energy level was still high and he cared. And he cared and he conveyed lots of things that would be what you might call hard to digest for parts of the plutocracy. When he talked about drug prices, talked about billionaires' taxes, when he talked about all kinds of things that the basic household has felt slipping away, he in some respects was answering the yearning that Donald Trump falsely fulfilled in 2016. And I thought, therefore, it was a very good experience for Joe Biden's candidacy to be the candidate, not be replaced by someone younger, you know, a Gavin Newsom or Roy Cooper or somebody. But he's still in the saddle. He's still sharp enough to be the quarterback when a lot of people thought he didn't have that mental equipment any longer. And then I thought the fact that he went to a vision of kind of a New Deal vision of the common man distribution and so forth, he's touched the buttons that a lot of people who would vote for Trump might now look the other way.
Okay, a lot to respond to. And let me first say, I'm not going to respond immediately to the speech, but to one of the things you're saying. I was speaking with someone yesterday, a pretty expert, well-published author. I won't name because she's not here to defend herself. And she said, among other things, she said that progressives hate poor people. And it was one line, but the basic premise was that progressives are not really dealing with meat and potato kitchen table issues. They're distracted by wokeness and blah, 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 right? Yeah. Which surprised me. She's a progressive herself, I think. And I said, but I would say the most prominent and effective progressive in the country is Bernie Sanders. And doesn't he, I mean, it seems to me he is basically a populist within the system. And she sort of conceded that, but didn't, and then she said to me, she said, well, where does Bernie Sanders matter today? Right. And I said, the right would say that Joe Biden is giving them a Bernie Sanders agenda. I think even if we go back to 2020, that was our hope. And to a great extent with the tight majority he had at first and then the minority he has in the House now, to have been able to come forward with that agenda and to get several significant things passed and others done by executive order is a real accomplishment. And mm-hmm. that sort of glib assessment seems to me to miss the on the ground reality.
And he kind of alluded to what you might call the plutocratic masks that he doesn't feel he wears last night when he admitted he was from Delaware. And Delaware is a place that's corporate headquarters. But he's saying, how come my dad never felt like anything got into our kitchen? And so he sided with the common man against those powerful forces in some of that dialogue.
And, yeah, and at I one think, point, again, he throws little lines as sort of, you know, he's making a big point, and I'll throw a little line. And when he did say, he said, you know, I don't hate corporations. You know, mm-hmm. he made mm-hmm. the point that
he said, I'm a capitalist.
That's
yeah.
right. That's yeah. right. And so I will go to one other thing, which is that, and I think this goes back to what you were saying when you mentioned those three markets, is that two different people that I interviewed over the last couple of years that are not usually in the same bucket. One is Rebecca Henderson at the Harvard Business School. And the other was Branko Milanovic, the economist.
Yeah, I've worked with him. Yeah.
Branko's one of the, you know, leading figures on global inequality and so on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what they both said, totally independently, was capitalism. They were both said, I'm okay with capitalism, probably somewhere on a continuum between the two of them. But the problem, capitalism has taken millions out of maybe billions out of poverty, et cetera, et cetera. But when it can write its own rules, when the market writes its own rules, that's when it's corrupted. And that is the situation now, exacerbated by Citizens United, dark money, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that goes to your point of the advertising, the political marketing, all of that. which
well, the question
is when capitalism begins to hurt instead of help.
Yeah, I'll put two on the table. Elon Musk gets support from the federal government for electronic vehicles. That's a good thing. Moderna and Pfizer get support from the tax base, you know, from federal revenue for R&D to address the pandemic. But there is a question that's missing. Why isn't their stock owned by the republic called the United States in both Tesla and those two drug companies as a result of having put that money forward? And so you can go on and talk other things about why drug prices are so high and why Elon Musk wants tariffs now against Chinese electronic vehicles and all kinds of stuff. But ordinarily, you can have something that has what you might call social good, what economists call externalities or public goods that need to be built. And it is the role for the capital to come, at least in part, from the public sector. But they should get a piece of ownership with that. And they didn't in this instance. And so I think there's a lot of suspicion. And when I talked about my three too many markets, my refraction of the Bob Dylan song, what bothers me is a well-intentioned individual may know that they can't survive without complying with all of those constraints. So however good your heart is, your vision is, are we going to pass it through two houses? Are the judges going to look at it fairly? You know, we talk about the division of power, the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the courts. When all of them are under these refractory pressures, are we going to get real outcomes? And then comes the real danger. And I want to cite my friend and a man I respect a great deal, Martin Wolf of the Financial Times, who wrote a book called The Crisis of Capitalist Democracy. And he talks about how when these systemic things, he doesn't detail them like I have, but these systemic things are refracting the outcomes. When a country's productivity goes up since 1985, but 85% of the people are doing worse, you have despair. And despair can lead to what you might call submission to fascism, to authoritarian, sometimes charismatics like Adolf Hitler. He sensed that Donald Trump had some of those characteristics. So in other words, the danger to everyone, including the billionaires, of a systemic failing of great breadth is part of what is frightening and haunting people. And I'll cite Douglas Rushkoff, who's a professor at NYU, wrote a book called The Survival of the Richest.
Yes.
And it was all about some events related to billionaires looking to create escape hatches, bomb shelters, self-sustaining food. In other words, they don't even think as billionaires that they can change the system. They got to find a way out for them and their loved ones. Playing in that scale of sophistication and being that despairing should haunt us all. And I think that's why Rushkoff wrote the book.
Yeah, and Jonathan Taplin, in his latest book, he really talks about how when your billionaires are talking about escape rather than construction, rather than creation, rather than, you know, and it's a weird thing to look at, whether it is escape to another planet.
Yes.
Or just escape from the, I mean, we've talked about a two-tier society for, 20 or 30 years, right? That if you live in a gated community, you don't mind that crime might be up. And if you go to a private school, you might not mind that public schools are in trouble. And if you, et cetera, you know, if you never have to deal with what but now I think, as you point out, whether it's building, buying the land in New Zealand or building the escape rooms or going to Mars, it's even gotten almost fantastic, a word that usually is used kind of, you know, not quite correctly, but in this case, I think it's true.
Yeah, well, I once gave a talk at the Getty Museum in Los Angeles, did a kind of, you know, a PowerPoint-like presentation, and I used Bob Dylan's song, Desolation Row. And when I stopped, you talk about T.S. Eliot riding in the captain's tower, and which side are you on, and all these things. But one of his verses was about the Titanic sails at dawn. And I put up a picture of the Titanic. I stopped my audio and I said, the reason I'm here is to ask you, are you here to help the captain and the navigator miss the iceberg? Or are you focused on getting all the jewels from the safe and the food from the galley into your lifeboat? And everybody kind of looked at me, and it was before this about 2014, but seeing this distress coming and what kind of fear, I mean, rich and poor people can each be afraid, and I'm not criticizing their fear, but when the wealthy and the powerful are afraid too, it's a very ominous time. And I think that at some level, the president was calling that out a little bit last night. He was saying, when he looked back at FDR, when he looked back at Abraham Lincoln, that there have been times when the whole essence, the fabric, the coherence of the Republic was being challenged, under distress. Yeah, in question. You have to rise. And that's why he wants to be the president again, he says, to do that. Now, I would have hoped there'd have been a chapter in his speech last night about repairing the three markets that I talk about as three too many markets for capitalism. I think that taking away some of the incentives, and as he talked about, have the billionaires pay taxes, but have a legislature that doesn't feel like they're going to get pushed out of their career. One famous senator, who I won't name, said to me, because I used to work in the Senate, and I saw him afterwards at a dinner, and I said, why did you retire? He said, that's easy. When 70% of your time is spent raising money from people who want you to do harm from your constituents, to harm to your constituents, it's not a pleasant thing to do with your life on earth. And he was speaking from a spiritual kind of place about what is my purpose on this planet. And it's not to burn myself out raising money and doing harm to the people who elected me and pretending I'm a leader in a democracy. And so the, what you might call the underside is, we can't, I don't want to be like idealistic and romantic, but we are struggling a lot now with the plutocratic pressures that inhibit, for instance, the implementation of climate change when the ice is melting and people can see problems all over the world. I can understand when homes in America are frightened of the idea that we're going to give capital through the World Bank to the African continent instead of taking care of their children in school. I'm concerned about, we have a very serious challenge coming up, which is the baby boom is aging out. The ratio of elders to the workforce is going to be at an all-time high, precisely at the time when America is paying twice as much for pharmaceutical products and medical care for elders as the OECD, meaning the other developed countries all over the world. And we're ranked 38th in performance for something that's double the price in terms of healthcare. So not only is that bad healthcare, but now you're asking all the young people to pay more and more taxes to pay for that, or to cut off their parents' healthcare as elders. Either one is a crisis. And add the Ukraine and Taiwan and the military industrial complex budget, which you might say, I'm not pretending Putin's innocent or a good guy or any of that kind of stuff. But when you add that military budget as the world leader in a military sense to that health budget, to our aging population, and you throw in how people might not think the dollar is the best international reserve currency anymore. So they may set the so-called BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and Saudi Arabia, create another reserve currency. Well, then all kinds of people aren't going to buy U.S. government bonds at exactly the time when we're in the distress.
Now, I mean, there's so much. Let me just jump in on that one question because I'm not clear about this. I thought the fear of, and for people who don't know, explain what you meant when you said the dollar is the currency of exchange and replacing it, because I think that's something many people do not either know or understand.
Yeah. Well, what happens is you have a foreign exchange market, but not everybody, whether in Argentina or in China or whatever, holds their own domestic currency. Some people keep their savings in gold. Other people keep it in the U.S. dollar. They buy U.S. government bonds. What I'm alluding to is that when that appetite for U.S. bonds is high all over the world, it creates a market for our government bonds and allows us to, how would I say, run bigger deficits. Deficits create more bonds, but there's an appetite to buy them and hold them. You don't have a crisis. You don't have a financial crisis. You don't have interest rates skyrocketing and pushing all the price of real estate and homes all over America down. But if that appetite for the dollar denominated bonds goes down, then the question of domestic crisis, interest rate default risk, and everything else come back to the table.
And wasn't this notion of the U.S. dollar as sort of the global currency come out of World War II? Am I correct?
Yes. Yes. We went from a British pound, sterling, and a gold standard. And then in the 1960s and 70s, we went to what you call floating exchange rates. We delinked from gold, and then it became a dollar standard. And at this moment, it still is. There isn't another currency.
I thought that fear was greater before. The fact that the U.S. economy is currently outpacing most of the other advanced economies, our inflation is lower, our employment is higher, and all, I would think that would give people a little, would calm that.
Yes, but I'll put something on the other side of the ledger. I agree with you. But on the other side of the ledger is when everybody says we store our stuff in dollars, because that's kind of the center of the world. The U.S. gets in a tension with Russia over the Ukraine, and we freeze Russian assets that were in dollars. All of a sudden, they said, oh, they could do that to me too. Years ago, when the United States did something like that, there was a thing called the Chiang Mai Initiative, Asian Development Bank, and they were talking about creating a Chinese RMB, renminbi, as that's their currency, store of value, but it denominated in that rather than in dollars. It didn't materialize. They hadn't taken off their capital controls. They weren't ready to be a global free market by any means at the time. But anxiety about how authorities will not honor and respect your holding your assets in there, because they use it as a political instrument, may shake people out of confidence, or at least not even contemplating that the dollar could be dangerous as a store of value.
I think that sounds to me related to Europe's decision-making over the last few months, that they have to think about providing their own defense. And it comes down to this thing that it seems like America changes more than other countries do when there's an election that goes the other way. In other words, what people have, it seems that the alert globally right now is, you can go from Biden to Trump. You can go back to Trump. You can go to another kind of Trump.
Right.
That you cannot depend on the U.S. because there isn't a center that has control anymore.
I want to take you on a little voyage with me, because when Trump was elected and he shifted towards anti-China, anti-Mexico. I was a speaker first at what's called International Economics Association talk in Mexico. And after I got off the stage, people came up to me and said, why is America so mad at Mexico? Well, you know, what's it, you know, and I said, well, there's problems at home, and sometimes you don't want to face your problems, so you find a scapegoat. About a week later, I flew to China, and I met a very high-level leader, not Xi Jinping, but a very high-level leader. And he said, Robert, I can see what Trump is doing, but I want to say something to you. And I said, okay. And he said, we are a very big country, 1.4 billion people. And when we started in the late 1980s and 1990s to integrate, we knew that it would affect America. We knew that our low cost, meaning 1/40th level of income, their labor costs were one, their living standard of their average person was 1/40th of the American. And he said, when you put these two together, the pressures in the system, Branko Milanovic has written a lot about this, by the way, that it is going to create a distress. But there is a parable in international trade theory and economics that says free trade can make everyone better off and no one worse off. That's true, provided that you make internal transfers to the people who are suffering and are the losers. America didn't do that. And I said, you're basically right. I grew up in Detroit. I watched this play-by-play with the decline of the auto industry. He says to me, Robert, what you got to understand is that we don't have the power to take away ourselves as a demon. If we were doing something that we were in control of, and then I talked to him about they had this report about how they were going to do things and build knowledge-intensive platforms, but as soon as they learned it, the foreign direct investment, meaning the foreign corporation, would be pushed aside, and they develop it domestically, and Americans were scared. This is people like Kirk Campbell, who's in the government now, wrote these things for the Council on Foreign Relations before Trump. And so I can see Trump as a symptom of the distress. I can see the Chinese feeling like the integration of the system and Trump's demonization of them is really dangerous because they can't do anything about it. It was up to the American government to take care of the people who were displaced so that the world system could cohere. And Trump didn't think, I didn't talk to him, I don't know, but I don't think he felt he had the power to be able to make those internal transfers in America. Just like Biden may declare we have a billionaire's tax, but how is he going to get it passed through two houses in the legislature?
Well, I think, as he said on the in his conversation or his section on Roe v. Wade, again, a line that almost was thrown away, give me the Congress who wants to do it, and I will sign, you know, Roe v. Wade into national law. I would say the same thing is true in terms of the transfers. And let me tell people, by the way, this is Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Rob Johnson. He's president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and host of the podcast Economics and Beyond. We're talking about the State of the Union, not just the speech, but the actual state of things. And as you can tell, that we're taking it globally as well as domestically. And you can learn more about Rob and the Institute at ineteconomics.org. ineteconomics.org. And let me, some friends of mine are putting on a virtual event next week, and they asked me if I would promote it, and I am going to. It's a virtual event to the ballot box, Our Vote, Our Voice, via Zoom, Saturday, March 16th. Everyone's invited, 2 to 3:30 p.m. Pacific, 5 to 6:30 p.m. Eastern. It features Latosha Brown, Cliff Albright. They're co-founders of Black Voters Matter. It's moderated by MSNBC's Joy Reid. And for info and to register, JusticeAid, one word, JusticeAid, JusticeAid.org. It's going to talk about the broad questions of voter and voter suppression and getting out the vote.
I wanted to bring up, you brought up Roe v. Wade last night, and I'm talking now about the cleverness of Joe Biden, because he is, and has said all along, he is Catholic.
That's
right. And the question of pro-choice versus pro-life is a moral dilemma that there isn't a clear answer. But the question of whether the government makes your choice or not is much broader than just the question of reproductive rights. And what Joe Biden did was saying, you guys are willing, when you talk about libertarians on the right, you guys are willing to play this game where you override our choice. And this will be a precedent that the Supreme Court can use to control many things in our life. So he didn't talk about the moral dilemma. And with his Catholic faith, I know he's, in the past been sympathetic to the pro-life movement, but he did talk about the way the court is changing the relationship between the government and the people in a way that will startle a lot of people who are traditional Republicans or libertarians or suspicious of government. I thought it was very, very insightful that he did that.
Yes, and when I saw a documentary on how same-sex marriage passed in Ireland, I'm reminded of that, of course, because you can see the similarity. Ireland is the Catholic country. And,
right.
And when they had this issue come up, and they passed it before we did, what worked was that it was about freedom. It wasn't about sexuality. It
right.
wasn't about even morals. It was about freedom. And when you make that case, you bring a lot of people along. And I think what you're saying is, yes, if they will do it on Roe v. Wade, and one could even say if they will, if this court will change gun laws that have been, since the 19th century and so on, what other freedoms will they take away when they're banning books?
Exactly.
What's weird, actually, is that their motivation is that the culture wars are what you have to play on if you have no policies. And
yes.
Yet what they end up doing is they end up actually, that's big government. That's the stuff that Steve Bannon rails against, the deep state. And I think there's a contradiction there that if expressed well, if repeatedly and repeatedly communicated that they talk libertarian, they govern Big Brother.
Yes. You mentioned earlier John Taplin. I always smile because he was Bob Dylan's road manager years ago for
That's
his tours.
Right.
And but John's new book talks about the whole notion of freedom being used by billionaires as a justification for doing nothing to, redistribute wealth or share wealth. And so the freedom of a handful of people in this instance comes to the detriment of tens of millions of people. And so how do you rebalance what I'll call freedom from the common good? And his book, I think it's called The End of Reality.
That's right.
Is talking about how the economies of scale that are achieved through digital technology, meaning one guy can run the whole network, like a Facebook with millions of people, makes it very hard for a competitor to create a second Facebook to compete with them. That's what economists call a natural monopoly. But when you centralize the control and power, like the movie, what was it called? Tristan Harris and others made.
Social Dilemma.
The Social Dilemma, yeah. They talked about the ramifications for debate, democracy, and all kinds of things of having these platforms egg on people by only telling them what they want to hear So they'll get excited, they'll stay on longer, and then they can pitch up their advertising rates. And so with these digital platforms now have tremendous value, but they also have some what I'll call side effects through architecture and social structures that come with them that we have to be conscious of. And I thought Taplin was doing a very good job of raising that tension to our consciousness in his book. I saw he and Thomas Friedman of the New York Times at the 92nd Street Y do a very nice presentation
And
on these things.
Taplin's previous book, Move Fast and Break Things,
Yeah,
was one
that's
of
right.
the first to really point out all of that. Move Fast and Break Things being kind of a slogan of Silicon Valley. Do it, don't get permission, just do it and then see what happens.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, to me, this is one. What you just brought up is one of the hardest things, I think, for us to deal with. I Europe has done a very different job at this, and you may know more than I. But one way that I look at it is that politicians have always, there has always been value in a politician who could manipulate people, in a political message that could tap into people's fears and grievances, et cetera. That's always been a value. But the idea that algorithms can now do it at the level of your neurotransmitters below your ability to even be conscious of what's happening to you is, I
Yes.
think, of another order, and one that we've never had to deal with before. And that, as I say, the solutions are hard to come by.
I've been a couple of different things related to all of these innovations and developments. I've been exposed to people, particularly in West Virginia, where I've given speeches, where they've said, "You grew up in Detroit. We agree that we've got to do climate change, but nobody gave assistance to the Rust Belt, Detroit, Cleveland, and whatever, when we went to globalization and the automobile was brought down. How are you going to take care of us when we shut down coal? And right now, what we're going to do is stay on the team with the fossil fuel industry until you guys create transformational assistance, education, assistance in moving, training for new jobs, community colleges, that kind of thing." I am reminded in 2017 on New Year's Eve, the author Peter Goodman, who's been a longtime friend of mine, wrote the book Davos Man, but he wrote a thing about how the Swedes love the robots in the New York Times. And what he said at an event at the Swedish consulate in New York about a month later that I attended is he said, "In Sweden, people love the idea of robots and technology because they know that their children's tuition, their health care, and their pension and their retraining will all be taken care of. But with the robots, the what's called production possibility frontier, the possibilities of being higher growth, more beneficial to the whole republic will be there." And what Peter's point was that in America, we used to have what we called supply side flexibility, and Europe was called sclerotic. But now, with the rage that Trump represented and the injury that many people were experiencing with globalization, machine learning, automation, that Americans would block the implementation of new technology because of their despair, while the Swedes, with all the transformational pipelines already built, would move ahead, and that quality of life in Finland and Norway and Sweden and a few other places. Yuzuki Sakakibara, former friend of mine, former finance minister of Japan, wrote a book about the transformation of capitalism in Japan, where the common good pathways were added to augment the unfettered free market. I think that we are at the kind of distress point that Peter Goodman and Sakakibara have alluded to.
Well,
And
one thing I always remember is the final line of Steve Bannon's interview with Charlie Rose, which was the first time many people actually were introduced to Steve Bannon in more than a clip or a cartoon, his final line was, "There's a populist revolution is coming.
Yes.
The question is whether it's going to be from the left or from the right."
Yes. And what you're talking about is
a populist revolution from the left, which all of which populist revolution and left are hot button words. But what you're really talking about is the common good.
Yes.
That the common good have standing when important decisions are made. And this is where, when I go back to even what I said in that 2020 intro, which is that we're going to come out of this pandemic. We're going to have to, is this an opportunity for common work toward the common good? And it turns out we are more fractured than ever. The need is even higher, and the context, the situation, the circumstances are even more dire, I think, in terms of
consciousness. Steve Bannon talked about his affinity for Donald Trump. And in the portrait that I saw him interviewed to talk about, what he said was his father had spent his life working as a phone pole guy for AT&T. And with the great financial crisis, his father's pension was wiped out. And then he said, and I'm going to quote from the left side, Joe Stiglitz, that we did the bailout of Wall Street that made the mess, but all we did was pay the polluters. That's Joe Stiglitz's phrase. We didn't make the structural reforms in finance, so it didn't happen again, as SVB and other things have shown. But my friend Alex Gibney, who you mentioned in the intro that I did some filmmaking with, made an audible course with David Sirota for 5 hours called Meltdown. And the meltdown they talked about was not the meltdown of the financial markets. It was the meltdown in faith and confidence in governance that led to Occupy Wall Street, a Tea Party, a Republican House under Trump, a Republican House under Obama, a Republican Senate under Obama, and then Trump's election. That all of this was symptoms of dysfunction and not adhering to the common good. I always think, and I've got to come down a stretch here because I've got to pick up kids at school. Mm-hmm. But the thing I always go back to was a man who inspired me when I worked for Bill Proxmire, because he walked in to the office and wanted to see my little daughter who was crying. His name was Muhammad Ali. And when he gave a speech at Harvard, they said, "Ali, what's your poem?" And he got back up on the stage and he said, "Me, we." That's the pendulum we live in. Me or we? What's the balance? We're way out of balance at this juncture.
So let's go back again to the speech or the campaign. I thought, by the way, I thought the speech in terms of, you know, if you say, so what does he have to do, right? The number one thing he had to do was, as you said, show the energy, the vitality, the quickness, all of those things.
Yes.
It sounds like you were either reassured sufficiently or felt you needed to be reassured sufficiently. I certainly felt he passed that. And in fact, I think...
Meaning his being the nominee from the Democratic side, does he still have the capabilities? Yes, I was reassured about that.
Right. And I'm not entirely reassured. And part of it is because afterwards, last night, in preparing for this conversation, I looked at Ezra Klein's, do you know what I'm talking about, in mid-February, when Ezra Klein in the New York Times...
Oh, yes, yes. Said, his thing about Biden should step down.
And, you know, we should have an open convention. Or what he said was actually subtle. He said, we should be prepared to have an open convention.
Yes.
If in May things do not look better than they did in mid-February.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of made me go, because I had written just a few days earlier that I had seen that Biden was talking about compromising a bit on emission standards. Okay. He has, I'm afraid it might be even affecting his relationship to the to Netanyahu and the Israeli approach to their attack on Gaza, that he's having to pull punches a little because he knows it's closer than it should be, and he knows the stakes. And what that led me to think about, this is not good. This is not good if he begins to slide because the race looks too close. I mean, it's good that if he ultimately wins. And I thought, he is shown so far to be a better president than I imagined. I'll bet the same is true for you.
I agree with that.
What he's been able to achieve with so much opposition, what he's actually gone after even, what has been his goals, his vision is better than I expected and what I hoped for.
Yeah.
And as a picker of a team and a manager of a team, he is doing great. The way he pulled together the coalition to support Ukraine, the way it's clear that in a room, you know, whether it's with senators or with leaders of other countries, he still has it. Is he a good enough candidate? Is still a little bit uncertain. In other words, yes, he came off last night. Can he do that every time? And I just wonder. You feel like that we're going to be okay in that regard. Doesn't mean he's going to win, but that he is sufficiently strong as a candidate.
Well, I guess my concern in the physical realm is how grueling a presidential campaign is. The idea that he could hide out for 3 weeks, get his energy up and be brilliant last night is a different challenge than the physical fatigue.
Skipping the Super Bowl interview, a time to talk to the country.
Yeah. So I don't know how to answer that, what you might call repeated performance capability, given his age and so forth. I do know that some people on the Trump side, the Republican side, were planning to show some advertisements that basically said, in fact, he's really running against Kamala Harris because Joe Biden isn't going to live for another 4 years. And I know Kamala a little bit through some friends in Northern California, and I wouldn't be afraid of that myself. I think I like her a lot better than what I hear my friends say. But the point is, he's trying to create a haunted feeling that you're going to have this person from California, who's a minority. We've never had a woman president. We should, but I'm just saying we haven't. So there's some dread, perhaps, in that locker. And so I think there's a whole lot of anxiety, but I think he did a very good job of stepping up to that challenge, looking it in the eye and flipping at the bird, if you will, last night.
Yeah, and I think we even both like the initial choice. You know, the way he started off the speech, it was not what we expect from a State of the Union speech.
Right.
Most of them start with about 2 minutes of boilerplate. I'm so honored to be here, and hello to you, and hello to you, and that kind of stuff. And he hit the ground running. Because I think he knows some people are going to watch 10 minutes.
What he did was very clever. He walked around and greeted everybody before he got on stage. But once he got on stage, he went right down the throat and said, I'm here and I run this place.
Right.
And so that, how do I say, I thought was a very positive development. And my own sense of this next dimension is if people are thinking about him as president, and he's saying, in my second term, I have this common purpose. That's a definition they haven't heard from people who were playing what I'll call the fundraising games, didn't want to create what I'll call false promises. But he went right out with it. We need this on billionaires, this on healthcare, this on reproductive rights, bam, 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 bam. And that was a vigor and a courage and a clarity that I think will affects how some people react.
I'll throw you my two thoughts. One is that I don't think it is a bad idea for the team to be thinking about what if something happens. Can we? And what Ezra Klein made a good point of, that an open convention and a new team of candidates, right, which might happen, would actually be not a problem, but a generator of energy. But I think that should be, people should be thinking that way just in case. But in the short term, say we go straight forward with, I think what we need is every charismatic Democrat out on everywhere you can find them. Gretchen Whitmore, Cory Booker, Barack Obama, Michelle Obama, Shapiro, yeah. You know, all Gavin Newsom, all of them recognizing that he is a better president than candidate, even though he made a great showing last night, and that they, it's okay to acknowledge that, I think, even, and yep. say there's a difference. We're here to tell you, not that behind doors he does fine, that's going to get tired, but we're here to tell you, this is what we're going to do, this is what the stakes are, this is what our vision is, and use surrogates in a way that they've never been used before. Now, the fact that he was willing to do things last night that are not usually done in State of the Unions tells me that perhaps they might be willing to do a campaign that's different.
Yeah. Well, I, as we've talked about a couple of times, worked in the United States Senate on both sides of the aisle for about 7 years. And I had done an internship before that on the antitrust subcommittee of the Justice Committee when Joe Biden was the chairman. I can give you abundant evidence that as an elected official, he really knows how to play the inside game. And the only concerns I had about him, because he talks like a guy that comes from middle class, common man, empathetic for the everyman. But I wondered myself in his heyday, not now, was he becoming too clever in playing the money politics game to actually practice what he preached? But I think right now, the calling of despair, the writings of Martin Wolf and Rachel Maddow and others,
Angus Deaton
and Angus Deaton and this, Hitler and the USA three-part series that was done as a documentary on PBS.org.
Rise of the Nazis. Nope.
Ken Burns made that. This is a time when somebody has to rise above. And I thought last night he stepped up and said, what really matters to me is what I'm going to go for, and painted a picture that should matter to you too.
Yeah. And I'm saying get as many folks out there, get the next generation out there painting that picture over and over
That's
again.
Right.
And
yes.
So you know, okay, this is what's going on. Thank you again, Rob.
My pleasure.
Let me tell
as
people,
always.
Rob is president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, host of the podcast Economics and Beyond. You can learn more about his work and their work at ineteconomics.org. That's I-N-E-T-E-C-O-N, ineteconomics, one word, .org. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join in the in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to TerrenceMcNally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to get my weekly announcement on who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 10 or 15 links to articles that flesh out the conversation. As I say, good news, bad news, it's there. You can email me at TEMcNally, TEMcNally, TEMcNally at mac.com. Or you can sign up at the website. You can also subscribe and listen to the podcast at most of those sites, at Apple Podcasts and Google Podcasts and so on. You'll find years of podcasts at those sites and at my site. Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, George Packer, and so on. You can follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to Kiana Williams in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. And finally, Rob Johnson, thank you and keep up your good work.
Well, thank you. You're a marvelous host and it was a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. And I'll see you right after the election.
Excellent.